And we're back.
Woohoo!
Yay!
Yes! Welcome, everybody, to The Matchup, a storytelling podcast from St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where you, the listener, gets to decide who told the most compelling story. I'm your host, Jason Franklin, and today we have the very awesome people, the Reverend Sarah Audrey Graves.
Hello, friends.
Hi, Sarah. And the Reverend Dixon Kinzer.
How's it going, everybody?
Good to hear from you both. It's been a minute.
Yes.
We took a little break because it gets a little busy here at St. Paul's around Christmas time.
Yes.
Just a wee bit. And actually, this was a pretty busy Christmas. Dixon, how was Christmas here at church?
It was awesome.
It was particularly awesome this year.
I agree.
Yeah.
Just we were back, you know, mm-hmm. And it was like people were back in church and we weren't having to juggle, are we going to mask or distance or whatever else? And so it really was joyful. And it was just, I mean, we had a good time just like being here with each other. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
I get to do this with some of my favorite people in the world.
This was the first year I actually went around and took pictures of like all of us doing our thing and kind of running around between the services. And you just sort of see the progression of like, Pretty face. I'm so tired. And Jesus is born. Yay. And I mean, it was just like the perfect capture of the way that Christmas Eve goes here. Cause it is, I think it's more tiring than Holy Week and Easter.
100%.
Because it's just such a long night. But that makes it sound like tiring means it's a burden. It's such a joyful thing.
Yeah.
It's just like stimulation overload. I get home at like 1 o'clock in the morning and I don't fall asleep until two.
At all.
No, because I'm so wound up.
Yes. Yeah. Totally
it's
wired.
It's been so fun.
Yeah.
And Sarah.
It smells like incense.
Yeah. It gets in your hair.
Does it?
But then just switch.
You might not know when you lay down on the pillow, you can smell it in your hair. Sorry, I didn't mean to call out your disability.
Since this isn't a visual media, if you haven't been to our church or met Dixon, he's a little bit follically challenged. Sarah, you were on the final episode before we took our break.
Yeah.
Have you had any time to reflect on your podcasting experience so far?
Well, what I really want to know is the results. Like, who voted for me? Who voted for Nancy?
Yeah.
Who's winning that one?
Currently, the winner is Advent.
What?
So okay. Good job, Nancy.
Yeah, Nancy's ahead. Not by much, though. Just a couple votes.
Yeah. That was a fun one to do because we recorded it, I think, in like close to Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So we were just in the throes of getting into the month, and it really set the mood for the rest of the months to come. Like Nancy did this really cool overview of all the scripture lessons of the Sundays in Advent. And then I just focused on Christmas, and it was just sort of like, oh, here we are. We're in the season, you know, it just sort of shifted. Except Nancy, who started listening to Christmas music on November 1st.
Was well
1st.
Into Christmas music
six, seven.
Like, by the time we recorded.
Good grief. She's like, Christmas is halfway over. But whatever, I'll talk about Anna.
All right, should we jump back into it?
Yeah.
I'm ready to get matched up.
All right, well, today we are discussing the best person from the Old Testament. Sarah, was there any specific criteria you used when you were trying to pick your person?
Just general awesomeness.
Just general awesomeness.
Okay. I just really was like looking over some of the, and I didn't want to do a repeat because there's been a lot of scripture study of the matchup, you know, through the fall, and we've gotten into some really interesting stories. So I wanted to do a new story. That was kind of my thinking.
That's good.
What about you, Dixon?
I picked based on kung fu acumen.
That's fair.
So
that okay.
Yeah.
My person
that's all over the Bible.
Yeah. It's replete, but there's a particular concentration of skills in this individual that I really want to bring forth.
Okay.
The Bruce Lee of the Hebrew Scriptures, they call him.
That sounds controversial, but
okay. Maybe you should bleep that part out.
In each episode, our two guests will present their case. We'll talk a little about it. And after the episode, you get to vote on who told the most compelling story. I'm the only person who knows what story each person is going to tell and who will go first until now. Sarah, would you like to go first?
Absolutely.
All right. Take it away.
All right. So We said best. The best person.
Yes, correct.
From the Old Testament is Esther.
Oh.
So I have a little visual that I will share with you all that I'm just sort of referring to that it was a picture I found on the internet from a children's like Bible study or a children's thing that lays out all of the characters of the story of Esther. And it really does well to just, I'm just going to show you, look at that picture of all of these different characters.
Oh, that's awesome.
That really kind of like shows who they are.
Cool.
So I'm going to just describe the lineup of the story of Esther and each of these characters and really describe like what is so important about the person of Esther and this story in the Old Testament. So to start off, oh, let me get my notes. Sorry. Hopefully you can bleep out all of my rustling pages.
No, it's Stan.
It's in here a lot. Oh my gracious. Where is it?
Dear listener, she's leafing through a legal pad.
Which is very full
every
of notes.
Every page is full of handwritten notes.
These are all classes and things that have been taught over the
it's
years.
It's very manifesto looking.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of beautiful mind. Like, what's that? That picture of that person from Sunny in Philadelphia. Sure. Crazy eyes. Yeah. So, Esther. Esther is a story and a character from the Old Testament that famously does not mention God, does not mention prayer, does not really situate the people in worship of God or in kind of moral, ethical, religious instruction in any way whatsoever. But it does include a lot of drinking, partying, sex, and violence. So
Episcopalians, pay attention.
Reason number one, it's an awesome book. It's just a fascinating story, and it's a very fun story.
Mm.
So the story of Esther is really starts with two characters. And the first is King Ahasuerus. And he is married to Queen Vashti. And they are, the story starts out where they are throwing this great big party. They are having this like drink fest, basically. And lest you think I'm being hyperbolic, the like in the first chapter, drinks were served in golden goblets, goblets of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. Drinking was by flagons without restraint.
There you go.
So they were throwing a party.
Flagons without restraint. And, great band.
I mean, yeah. I would go to that. So they're throwing this party. King Ahasuerus gets drunk, and he asks his queen Vashti to dance naked at the party.
Okay.
And she thinks about it and says, no, no, thank you. I don't want to do that. And King Ahasuerus gets so annoyed and so frustrated that he decides he needs to marry some other woman and make somebody else king, so queen. So they bring in a group of virgins for him to choose from. And he chooses this one woman, Esther, who is a Jew. But no one knows that. She conceals her identity from the king, from everyone around her, from the whole community, and doesn't really show any Jewishness in her character. Like, doesn't have this kind of sense of identity to a body of people. And King Ahasuerus is just so impressed with her beauty, and he marries her. Another character that is in the room, however, is Haman. And the picture that I just showed you all, there are all these faces of these different characters looking very kind of dramatic. Haman is dressed all in like dark purple, and he's got this like stringy black hair, and he looks mad. He's just sort of growling at the viewer in the picture. And I think he looks a little bit like Professor Snape on Harry Potter.
Yes.
Like in this picture, he really just looks like, I'm a bad guy. I'm the bad guy here. And that's his character for the entire story of Esther. He's the bad guy. And he immediately has this kind of posture of suspect toward everyone around him. But he has been appointed the just an official in the king's court. And he is really impressed with himself. He just really wants everyone to honor him and support him in everything that he does. Esther has a cousin named Mordecai who sits at the city gate and kind of hangs out, and he kind of knows what's up with all the people. He's also Jewish. And Mordecai is walking by, or Haman is walking by one day, and Mordecai refuses to bow to Haman. He's just like, that's not, I'm not going to tell you why, because I'm a Jew, but I'm not going to bow to you. You are not the boss of me. And this doesn't sit well with Haman. So he goes to King Ahasuerus and starts talking crap about Mordecai and starts laying the groundwork to get him out of the community and even to kill him. And he even lays down this argument that not only Mordecai needs to be killed, but we need to undertake the entire Jewish people. We need to destroy all of the people. His argument is there is a certain people scattered and separated among all the peoples in the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws. So it's not appropriate for the king to even tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued for their destruction.
And sounds familiar.
Right. Yeah. It's not just one guy that does something wrong for the exchange between Haman and Mordecai. It's like Haman is now discriminating everyone that comes after him. And so Mordecai goes to his cousin Esther, newly made queen, and basically says to her, you're in this unique position to help us out. And this could be your moment. And she kind of initially resists and is just not so sure about helping the Jews. And like, she's not so confident in her role. And Mordecai's argument is, if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's family will perish. Oof. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this.
Ooh.
And it's this kind of like seminal moment. And she's like, you got a point. Okay, I will help the Jews. So as you do when you're about to kind of like politic and get your way, you throw a series of parties.
Okay.
And you drink some more and you get the king drunk. And every time the king gets drunk, you present yourself to him as queen and he extends like his royal scepter or his ring. It signifies like she's going to get whatever she wants. And so she says, we'll come to the next party the next night. And it just goes on for a little while. While all the partying is happening, it gets worse between Haman and Mordecai. Haman decides to build a gallows in the center of town to hang Mordecai. And it's like sort of specifically laid out how he does this. And it just starts getting more and more tense. And then after one of these really big, lavish parties, the king is not able to sleep and he learns some good stuff about Mordecai. He's like, oh, you helped me out in the past. I see that you protected me and you looked out for me when I was going to be assassinated. And I just want to raise you up. And Haman wanders into the room and he's like, what are you thinking and talking about? And he's like, did you know this guy Mordecai is kind of awesome? And Haman is like, oh, no, I can't believe it. And so the king just sort of wants to bring Mordecai in from the city gates and put him in royal robes and bring him into the court. And as he does so, he's kind of like, to Haman. And in all of this kind of transition, Esther comes into the room and she's like, there is one among us who plots the destruction of my people. And King Ahasuerus, you need to know about this. Like, this is, my heart is so heavy. I'm so worried about my people's future. And we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed and to be killed and to be annihilated. If it was just about being slaves, men and women, I would have held my peace. But no enemy can compensate for this damage to the king. But she's like really politic and hard,
yeah,
right?
She is.
Like she knows exactly how to like twist his yeah. heart in the direction of saving her people. And King Ahasuerus, who you get kind of a sense like he's just sort of like, what's happening in my own court? I don't even know. King Ahasuerus is like, what do you mean? Who are you referring to? And Esther is like, it's Haman. It's the person you trusted the most. And he's like, no. and he's like, immediately, Haman needs to be killed.
Oh, geez.
And so, irony of ironies, King Ahasuerus sends Haman to the gallows that he had planned on hanging Mordecai on.
Oof.
So, yeah, yeah. And everything sort of shifts after that. Esther then has to kind of rise and speak and really kind of tell the truth about who she is, which has been hidden up until now, that she's a Jew. And she says that the Jewish people must be saved. And, you know, I can't bear this. And we need to, you know, protect the people going forward. And the king does. And then they, you know, all of the enemies of the Jews start being destroyed in battle. And there's all this like favorable stuff that happens for the Jews that kind of signifies this was the right path to go. Like this, the protecting these people is a good thing. And then the final chapter of the book is all about how the Feast of Purim is established, which much like some of the other feasts of the Old Testament, Purim is celebrated just by the Jewish people at a certain time of the year, every single year. And to the tune of the book, it is a good party. It is a lot of eating and a lot of drinking. In fact, there is one rabbinic text that says that you need to drink so much that you can't tell the difference between the name Haman and Mordecai. And they do
awesome.
Dramatic plays where they basically enact the story that I've just told you. And every time Haman comes on stage, or even when Haman's name is said, they start booing and stamping their feet so that you can't hear the name Haman said. And so it's just like a really good time.
Yeah.
But the thing that's really interesting about Purim and the character of Esther is that in Purim, you wear masks. You're supposed to conceal your identity because the name Esther means hidden. This is kind of the essence of her character in this book. And even in being this like strong female protagonist, there's something about her character that is getting what she wants and moving things forward in a very sly way, how should I say this? She's really good at using, concealing her identity for her own benefit, and for the benefit of her people. And my argument, I think the obvious answer to why she's the best person in the Old Testament is that she single-handedly saves her people.
That's
like
fair.
She saves the Jewish people. And that's the story that's where the story ends for her. But there are other things that I think are just interesting about it. Like there's something that I think is this like kind of point for us of spiritual engagement with this story, that Esther's story in being hidden and concealing her identity as a Jew woman, there's also an essence here of God's hidden identity. You don't ever hear the you know, name of God spoken in the entire book, but that doesn't mean that God is absent. That doesn't mean that God is like missing from this story. So it's a story about when God is hidden, when we can't figure out what God is up to, what do we do? What do we do with circumstances that are out of our control or even in situations that could cause destruction or violence? Like, how do we intervene when we're not sure what God is up to? Sometimes we are called to act. Sometimes we are called to step in. And so it's a story about vocation and considering what is really ours to do. That famous line about perhaps you have been, you know, made queen for a time such as this. I think that's a devotional point for us. Like, we have all been given gifts. We have all been given resources and even been given circumstances that we didn't expect or that we didn't think that would matter that much at all. And those circumstances lead us to a really powerful path forward and a vocational identity that is just really good. This book of Esther is often compared to Ruth, which is close by in the Old Testament, which I won't summarize Ruth right now. But like, if Ruth is kind of the story of a foreigner in Israel, then Esther is the story of the Israelites in a foreign land. And for just a kind of history lesson here, after the second destruction of the temple, the Israelites were in captivity. They were in exile. And so they really needed stories that would tell them what it meant to be in a foreign land. Like, how do I have hope? How do I think about the future at all if I'm stuck in captivity? If all I feel is pain every single day, and I think my children being born in captivity will never know freedom. They needed stories like this that said, here is what happens when God's people are in a foreign land. And here is how the people will be saved, even through unusual circumstances, even when it seems like God is completely absent. God is just simply hidden. God chooses to hide himself. There's even a reference to that in, I think it's Deuteronomy, I will surely hide my face. So it's got this echo of like, God said he was going to do this. Like, this is from early on. God said, I will hide my face. Like, expect that there will be some times when you don't know what I'm up to, when I seem to be gone. And I think that can be like really, really powerful. And it's a really powerful image to think about, like, all joking aside, all of the like feasting and partying and drinking. There's one rabbinical tradition that says that this is actually an image of the heavenly banquet. And this one rabbinical tradition says that this feast is eternal, that after the feasts of Passover and the observance of Yom Kippur are sort of when they come to an end, when they are consumed by the peace of God, Purim will still exist, that the feasting and celebrating and the telling of this story will still happen, because this is the story of hope in extreme circumstances. And it's the story of salvation and God's people being saved. So that is the story of Esther, why she's awesome, why she's the best figure in the Old Testament.
Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah.
That was awesome. I learned some stuff.
Yay.
That was really cool.
Yeah.
Dixon.
I love Esther.
Yeah.
No, it's so great. I like how you're framing the story in like the way that Esther like affects the salvation of her people. It reminds me of the right-handed, left-handed power thing. Like, right-handed power is like the closed fist, the hammer, the like force, and then left-handed power is like influence. It's the smell. It's the kind of let me entice. It's working kind of behind the scenes. And Robert Capon uses those to illustrate Jesus's power versus Caesar's. And so it's very like what she's up to. She's not coming in trying to like swing a sword or you go after Haman. Like, she's working this different angle that is a lot more in concert with how God affects change in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a good point. Yeah. She finds power in kind of quietly being in the background and quietly influencing and bringing a story to the one person who can make the change happen, you know? Yeah. Yeah, it's very cool.
And it's like delicious and Shakespearean.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
So it is like,
it's so dramatic and it's fun to read. Like it's, there are parts of the Bible that are really a chore, but like, this is not a chore. This is so,
it hums.
So good to read.
Have you seen the VeggieTales adaptation?
I did not know that existed.
It's really good. It's nice. Really, really good.
That's good to know.
I will, I'll find a link.
We show can notes.
Put it in the show notes.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. It's awesome.
Did you, did Esther pop into your mind at all when you were picking your pick?
No, but I'm glad that, you picked him up, or her up. Sorry, I'm distracted, dear listener, because someone's walking in the hallway behind Jason and we're all bracing to see if they're going to walk in the room and disrupt us. Because I chose Moses.
Your reaction, Sarah.
Well, so I approached this like, all right, if you're going to go best, I was thinking like, what is going to be the figure that's going to represent
the heavy hitter,
the influence and stuff.
Yep.
And it, the way these texts are written, these ancient texts, like, it's mostly dudes that get the top billing. And so I actually had a note in here to talk about the difference of, like, we talk about the patriarchs, but they're not the patriarchs without the matriarchs. And you find this very dynamic underneath all the stories of, you know, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, all of them there are women that are in the mix that God is far more, in fact, the women frequently are the ones that are faithful and working with God in salvation. The men are like screwing it up and messing it up. And so there's a subversiveness to that, that it's delightful to have Esther. Not so delightful that it's better than Moses, but delightful that I think it really helps to make my point all the more.
Fine. Bring it. Go on.
All right. But there are overlaps, right? Because like Esther, Moses also is instrumental in single-handedly saving his people, right?
Yeah.
Like Esther, Moses is working for God in a foreign land. Mm. So chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, you know the story of Moses. But I will say, like, you're choosing Esther because it's a story that hasn't been told. I picked Moses because it was like the, you know, five paragraph essay person that you would need to write about to answer the question that the teacher has given, but also because there's a bonkers Moses story that I've wanted to do on the matchup.
Okay.
And so
there you go.
It's really my,
Okay.
All right. So here's the deal with Moses. Moses is an Israelite and he's born in Egypt during a time when, the Israelites have ended up in Egypt because there was a famine in their land. And this is the whole, like, Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat story that ends up Joseph in Egypt and the family come. And talk about melodrama. The Joseph story is another one where the family shows up and they don't recognize him because he's in Egypt and he looks Egyptian. And anyway, they basically end up saving the whole land and the whole tribe ends up in Egypt, rescued from this famine because of the work of Joseph. And while they're there, the Pharaoh dies and a new Pharaoh comes to power, who the very beginning of Exodus says does not know Joseph or did not know Joseph and doesn't know the people. And so this Pharaoh sees these Israelites and how they're thriving and how they're growing and is like, these people are a threat to me. Like, how can we be sure they're not going to rise up and take my power, right? Which is ironic too, because in Egypt, Pharaoh was God. So you've got a God that feels threatened by people, right? This is another little subtle dig at imperial power. So Pharaoh says, all right, here's what we're going to do. He tells all the Egyptian midwives, if these Hebrew women bear sons, throw them in the Nile and drown them. And so
that was an appropriate time to gasp.
It's very, very Purim play of you. You want to boo Pharaoh when I bring him up?
Yeah, yeah.
So Moses's mother, Moses is born into this context, and his mother knows this. And so she's not going to give him up to be killed. And the Egyptian midwives are also kind of like, they're not they're not buying it. And so they put Moses, she puts Moses in a reed basket and floats him down the Nile. And famously, Pharaoh's daughter is in the Nile bathing, and the basket arrives, and she opens it, and there's this baby. And where did this baby come from? And so she raises him up and decides, I'm going to keep this baby and raise him as my own son. And she names him Moses, because I drew him out of the water. And the name Moses in Hebrew sounds like to draw out, which is another sort of play on this character's name, because he is the one that draws them, Israel, out of slavery in Egypt. So Moses is very much like a bigger than life character in the way his story is told in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy. So there's, it is like, we are in theological history here. Yeah. Like it is written to amplify themes and characteristics. It ain't doing camcorder history. Dear listener, a camcorder is a device from the past that used to use physical tape that would record images and audio that you could then play back on a VCR and watch it.
VHS tape.
Okay, so basically, Moses grows up in the household of Pharaoh. He's an Egyptian. And one day he sees an Egyptian taskmaster beating a Hebrew slave. His people are slaves. And he, in a fit of rage, intervenes and kills the Egyptian, and is suddenly like, "Ooh, I might be wanted for murder." And so he runs and he flees and he goes to the land of Midian, and decides, "I'm just going to live my life here." And so he meets Jethro and he becomes a shepherd for Jethro. And while he's out tending the flocks in the wilderness, he comes upon a bush, and it's a blaze, and yet it's not being consumed. Have you heard this before? So God speaks to him through the burning bush and says, "Hey, my people, your people are slaves. You need to go tell the Pharaoh to let them go." And Moses is like, "This sounds like a terrible idea. I am not equipped for the job. It is above my pay grade, and I haven't had the training." And your Lord is like, "Do it." And he gets mad at him, but basically they have all this sort of back and forth, and God will not relent, which is going to prefigure what happens with Pharaoh, where God will not relent and asking for what God wants. And God gives Moses his brother-in-law, Aaron, says, "Take your brother-in-law. He's a good orator. If you're scared about public speaking, go ahead. You should do this for the lay preaching mission. This should be part of the thing."
Yeah.
So if it's too hard to do, get somebody else to do it. So Moses goes back, and you know how the story goes. He confronts Pharaoh. Pharaoh kind of laughs. He's like, "What?" He's like, "I'm not going to release these slaves to go worship their God," air quotes. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just lazy is what they want. And so Moses then, under the instruction of God, is like, "If you don't do this, there's going to be consequences in the form of these plagues." And so these 10 plagues overtake the land of Egypt. And they're very interesting in how the plagues are tied into the Genesis creation poem. There's all kinds of like thick poetry going on in the way that story is told. But so ultimately, the final plague is the death of the firstborn, and the angel of death is going to come over the land. And so God tells Moses, "Tell the people, slaughter a lamb, put the blood of the lamb over the lintels of your door. The angel of death will pass over you." And so they do that. The angel of death does pass over all of the Hebrews. The Egyptians lose their kids, including Pharaoh. And in this grief, Pharaoh's will is finally broken, and he releases the slaves. So the Israelites, they leave. On the way out, they like grab stuff from the Egyptians, which is something that's been woven into the story the whole time. God's like, "By the way, when you get out of slavery, you'll take their gear." They do. And so they take the gear, and as the story goes, you know, Pharaoh chases them, changes Pharaoh's mind, and they end up at the Red Sea. And this is where Moses famously, with the power of God, you know, parts the Red Sea. The Israelites walk through, the sea closes over Pharaoh and Pharaoh's chariots, and Israel is saved, and this is the Passover, right? So then, but that's not the only thing that happens with Moses. Then you've got, they go to the base of Mount Sinai, and they receive the law through Moses. And this is like the giving of the Ten Commandments, which is the first of all of the law that follows, where basically through Moses, they get they get how to live with God in the world. There has never been a place in human history where a deity was like, here's how to be with me. And like in the ancient world, there was anxiety about like, are the gods for me or against me? How can I know if they're on my side or if I'm on their side? How do I know if we're okay or not? And there's like great, that's why like animal and then human sacrifice was like part of religious observance in the ancient world. Because, well, if you've got lots of anxiety and you're disempowered and you don't know if you depend on your gods, you think for, you know, your very sustenance, the sun and the rain and your crops and the weather, but things aren't going well because there's a drought or a flood or whatever. Well, what are you going to do? You got to amp up your sacrifice, right? And so you kind of project that forward and you start to see why the practices around the Israelites involve things like sacrifice your kid to Molech. So anyway, Moses gives them this, the law, and the law is really comprehensive. It's not just the Ten Commandments, which were the 10 words. It is everything from like, here's how to set up your entire society, like from the laws to the way like your civil structure will work, to like, what does taxation look like, to how do you build your religious system, and like the tabernacle and the vestments and all those things, right? So all of that is Moses, the manna, when manna and quail are provided, happens through Moses.
Yeah.
The golden calf happens under Moses' watch. That's a whole other story. But Moses, in all of that, leading the people through the wilderness for 40 years, because when they first get to the promised land, they won't go in because they're afraid of it, because they think there's giants. And then God's like, well, none of y'all are going in. Your kids are going to go in. So they wander for 40 years. And Moses himself doesn't get to go in because of his own bad behavior. So Moses is both kind of like, you know, legend of the faith and cautionary tale. The reason I would say he is like the best, obviously, is because number one, Exodus, it is said, is like the central story of the entire Bible, Christian Bible, Old and New Testament, and like everything else is commentary on it, right? So you get that sense that like, whereas like what happened in the Exodus is disclosing things about God and the nature of God and people and what God wants for God's people and what God wants for the whole creation and what God intends to get for the whole creation, liberation, freedom, healing. And Moses is the center of that. Like he at least as that story is told, right? Similarly, I think another reason Moses is best is because at least the Gospel of Matthew frames Jesus's gospel story through the lens of Moses. Like the way Matthew adds all this stuff in his gospel to make Jesus this new kind of Moses figure. Because as Moses led the people out of slavery in Egypt into the promised land and freedom, so Jesus will lead the entire creation out of sin and death into God's new world, the new heaven and new earth. So you get stuff like the slaughter of innocents, right? That's only in Matthew, and that mirrors Pharaoh's ordering of all the kids to be thrown in the Nile, right? Jesus gives, there's two versions of Jesus's like manifesto sermon in the, what we call the Sermon on the Mount. It's in Matthew, he's on a mount, but in Luke, it's the Sermon on the Plain. He like gives it in this flat area. Well, Matthew puts him on a mountain because he's Moses, the lawgiver, right? You know, he's like, so you get these sort of like things. You've got Jesus being tempted for 40 days in the wilderness. That's in more gospels, but that mirrors the 40 days of wandering. So you get those overlays that Matthew intentionally is using. And I'm just going to say this, he's not figuring Jesus on Esther. Dear listener. All right. That was cool. You should vote against me for that sassy remark.
Deduct some points. Cheap shot.
So that is, oh, and then finally, the reason Moses is best is because he's also the template for contemporary heroes. Superman, Superman's origin story, he's created by two good Jewish boys, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who take this story of a baby from another land and is put in a reed basket and sent away to another place, who's raised by other parents and becomes this kind of great liberating figure to save people. That's like, Superman is famously prefigured on Moses. So that's why Moses is best. But dear listener, we're not done.
Oh.
Oh.
Because here is my bonkers Moses story. The whole thing is for this story. all right. So the time in this story, I know I kind of like overly told the first part of Moses' story, but it's because I wanted to establish the timeline where like he leaves Egypt, goes to Midian, he gets married, he's got like this life, and then Yahweh speaks to him out of the bush, and it's time to go back under Yahweh's direction to tell Pharaoh. So on the way back to Egypt, all right, it's Moses, his wife, and he's got some kids at this point, all right? And there's this two-verse story that goes like this. On the way, at a place where they spent the night, this is on the way back to Egypt, at a place where they spent tonight, the Lord met him and tried to kill Moses. But Zipporah took a flint, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched his feet with it, and said, "Truly you are a bridegroom of blood to me." So he let him alone. It was said then that she said, "A bridegroom of blood," because of circumcision.
Cool.
Then the Lord said to Aaron, "Go into the wilderness and be by his side."
What is that?
All right, so that thing is bonkers weird.
Yeah.
It's super strange. And the thing is, nobody really knows what it means.
Huh.
Because it's dear listener, you're basically dealing with like all kinds of strange ancient customs that are being like alluded to with the assumption that everybody knows what you're talking about. Like that Zipporah would obviously know that, like, I don't know, if God intervenes and comes and tries to kill you, that the answer is to cut your kid's foreskin off and then put it on something.
Right.
Right, that would be the obvious choice, you know?
Sure.
So
here,
like,
I'll save the day. I know exactly how to handle this.
Poor kid's like, wait, but what's
happening?
What are you solving?
Are you sure?
Can we talk about this first?
What about the sacrifice part? Maybe that's easier. So yeah, it's like there's some background to it that's weird, and then like what's even weirder is that all the places where I read like Moses in the story in Hebrew, they're not actually there. Like it's just the word him.
Mm.
So it's unclear as to like when the Lord wants to kill someone, is it Moses that is being attacked here, or is it Moses' son? The son's foreskin is what's cut off, but when Zipporah touches the foreskin to someone's feet, is it the kid's feet or Moses' feet?
Yeah, I was going to say, where's that going exactly?
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, dear listener, feet in Hebrew is also a euphemism for genitals. Now we're going to get explicit.
Yeah, we are.
So it's weird. And some translations even take the word, like the Lord met him, as the Lord seized him. So the picture we're getting is like they're going back to Egypt, and for some reason God has kind of met this traveling party, and most people would agree that Moses is afflicted somehow. Like they know something's wrong because Moses has like a seizure or he faints or something, but basically Moses is incapacitated, which means it's up to, of course, Zipporah to save the day,
sure.
Right?
Mm.
A la Esther. And so, to Sarah's point, though, how does Zipporah know, like, oh, I got it! This is what needs to happen. The vague scholarship that's around suggests that in ancient Midianite culture, they had a different circumcision ritual than the Hebrews do. Than what happens here. It's sort of, certainly than what happens here,
right.
But like what happened according to the law of Abraham, or the covenant with Abraham, was you're supposed to be circumcised on the eighth day, right, of the baby, the baby's life. In Midian, you were circumcised, they think, before your wedding. So leading up to a wedding, dude would be circumcised, have a little recovery time, ceremony, consummation, reception. So the thought is that basically God is upset or is challenging the people because they've raised their kid as a Midianite, not as a Hebrew, because they're living in Midian, probably to honor father-in-law Jethro.
Interesting.
And so before they can go back and like engage in this holy work, you know, they've got to like right-size the ethnic alignments here. And so Zipporah's like, shut off, let's handle this. That was both in gesture and sound effect exactly as it should be.
I'm sure that's exactly how it happened.
That's where the kung fu comes in.
Yeah, yeah.
Which brings me to the feet part, because they also are sort of supposing that in that Midianite ritual, part of the way it worked was the removal of the foreskin, and then like some sort of like, you know, touching it to the genitals was like the way of saying the ritual is now complete. It was like just part of the way the Midianites did it. Mm-hmm. And so she's kind of like in this place saying, hey, look, you're Midianite, but you're a Hebrew kid, and you are now like bonded to our family. You're part of this covenant people. Like, we're in it together, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Sure. You know, it's like this picture of that through that ritual. And then the story moves on.
Okay.
Because we needed to clear that detail up.
No, like, reflection or explanation.
No.
Or like.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And oh, and that's because the bridegroom of blood, bridegroom, also means kinsman. And you'll actually find those words used interchangeably in Ruth also. Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. And feet.
Yes. Yes.
We were more on the same page than we knew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Sarah. Mm-hmm. How would you preach that?
I wouldn't. I'd be like Bishop Curry and be like, let me lift a text. I don't want to preach on that.
Ever?
I'll preach on this other thing.
No, it's not the lectionary. That
would be funny, though.
It would be like, that'd be the one where everyone would be like, what?
I'm coming to church this Sunday.
Yeah.
That's like the extra scene in a Marvel movie where it's like, you're not really supposed to understand what's happening because it's going to be a later movie.
Yes.
You're just supposed to get this like weird like preview.
It's the after credit scene of the Burning Bush episode.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that is why Moses is the best, for all the reasons I stated before, and super bonkers story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he had a lot of other like super bonkers things happen to him. Like when he was recruited to save God's people, there was like a changing of a staff into a snake, and then
yes,
back to a staff again, and he's like, whoa,
yes,
what are you doing? And
yes,
God's like, ah. it's stuff like that where you're like, this is a very interesting relationship that God and Moses have.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know that there's ever, other than Jesus and God, I don't know that there's ever any other character in the Bible that has this kind of like intimate back and forth with God, where it's kind of playful at times and then it's kind of hateful at times and wrestling with just the, like, Moses had to deal with so much complaining in the desert.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, like, yeah, like anytime if you ever have to deal with just difficult people consistently over a long period of time that will not be happy no matter what you do, read the story of Moses in the desert with the Israelites, because like it was just constant complaining about everything he did. And yeah, I mean, he's a great character. He's great.
He is a great
character. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
But so is Esther.
But so is Esther.
Now that you know what Dixon picked, what are your thoughts compared to Esther?
Like, is my mind changed?
Sure.
No.
It was a quick no.
But I do love the character of Moses. And I think that other stories in the Old Testament sometimes get more play. I mean, you hear his birth story in children's Sunday school.
Yep.
And you hear the story of the plagues at the Easter Vigil, I think.
Yep.
And you hear the story of the Exodus, like the whole like crossing of the Red Sea. That's a big part of the Easter Vigil service. But in terms of just like really getting to know him as a character, you don't really get a chance to do that much in church. So, yeah. I mean,
that's a good point.
Yeah.
He's very multi-layered. So, yeah.
I remember growing up, there was a period where we wouldn't celebrate Halloween. And so we would go to the church's like harvest festival on Halloween.
Sure.
And the instead of costumes, everyone was invited to dress up. All the kids were invited to dress up as character from the Bible, and everybody wanted to be usually John or one of the 12 apostles. I remember one year one kid came out as Moses, and it was like, ooh, that is so cool.
Yes.
Look at him. He's from the Old Testament. Wow. Everyone was like, wow, mind blown.
Yeah.
Side note, one of my friends from Nashville who went to my, or he was in my former parish, he's a guitar player, he's in Georgia Clay, and got famous for dressing up as Moses and going to Nashville's Premier League soccer team matches and like is now known as Soccer Moses.
Soccer Moses.
And like, dear listener, Google Soccer Moses, my friend Steve. And he's like, he's been on TV commercials. He played he played guitar live at one of their games, like for a promo thing. Like it's a whole phenomenon. Merch, t-shirts. He has a mural station in Nashville. Like it's, and wow. Steve is uniquely gifted at marketing quirky stuff too.
Sure.
So yeah, Soccer Moses too. So I was thinking Moses. A little of Soccer Moses, but yeah. Yes, dressed fair. Like Moses.
With a long beard and
a sign that says, let my people go.
Oh no.
it's everything.
Wow. Amazing. Well,
thank you, y'all.
Yeah,
thank you. It's awesome.
It's been a minute and it's great to be able to get back into it.
Yeah.
This is really fun.
Yeah. So the cases have been presented, and now the power is in your hands, listeners. In the episode description and notes is a link to a poll. Let us know who you think told the most compelling story. Please like and subscribe if you want to hear more. You can also learn more on our webpage, thematchuppodcast.com. We have a whole new set of themes coming up all the way till summer. We also have several new presenters that I can't wait to have on the show. So be sure and check back weekly for new episodes. Thanks everyone for listening and voting. See you next time.